welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 125, Accelerating Evolution, Redefining Retreats.
Greetings, everyone. Happy 4th of July. 4th of July is a big holiday in the U.S., celebrating the independence of the United States from Great Britain, which was a really good thing at the time. Although, I did like the editorial in the New York Times the other day about how, by some British guy who loves America, saying maybe we should have had a constitutional monarch, should have let George Washington be the king and then have a prime minister. Then we wouldn't have this personality cult competition that we have for the presidency, who are temporary kings. You know, you'd have one sort of ongoing one who didn't actually have political power, monopolizing the charisma. So then the prime ministers couldn't, I mean, still charisma would be a factor, but it wouldn't be a deciding factor. I'd rather programs and what they were going to do for the people and what their proven track record was, etc., they could be looked at more critically by the electorate. And I myself have been thinking, since I've seen the corruption by money of our democracy, I've been thinking that way. So I was pleased to see that. He did it in a very light and nice way. I forgot the name of the guy. About how it might have been smarter to have a constitutional monarch, like Sweden and Norway and Britain itself, you know. Anyway, here we are. People are on summer. It's time for vacation. Time for retreats. And I always say when people come to Menla, to our retreat center, and resort and spa up in the Catskills, I always say, don't think it's a retreat, it's an advance. Actually, when you retreat from whatever your daily activity is, which a lot of us, it has to do with work, or even if we're wealthy enough where we don't have to work, it's work being wealthy. So it's a kind of work. There's a worry level of keeping the wealth, etc., that's like a work. And so that's a lot of what we do in the daily life, and that we, unfortunately, we associate that with advance, you know. We get older, we get more well-known, we get more wealthy, we get more status, we get more whatever. It is more fun, you know, and we think we're going forward, you know. And so then when we're not doing that, we call that a retreat, like we're going backward, like retreating in a battle, you know. But and we have a French famous thing, as I like, reculer pour mieux sauter, to withdraw, to draw back in order to jump higher or jump better in the future. I like that a lot. And idea. But I call it an advance because why? What is the purpose of human life? You know, this is basic Buddha's teaching, you know, what they call dharma. Dharma means teaching, not doctrine, not thing to believe. And it means the reality also that is taught. And so dharma can, and it can mean many things actually. Dharma has 11 major meanings. But the basic starting point of his dharma is to realize what you are as a human being. And what are you as a human being? You are just a body. That's what the scientists tell you. So then your whole preoccupation, and that's what is the consensual view in our society, so that's what we all kind of tend to think. But in that case, therefore, it's logical, if that is really what you are, then it's logical to maximize your pleasure in this life and not worry about what happens in the next life, because there is no next life. You just become unconsciously nothing. But the good thing about that they promise you, and the question is it a valid promise or not? But anyway, they promise you that you will have at least anesthesia. You will not have pain after death. And that's, of course, what people flock to that idea, to get away from all those preachers who threaten them with hell, you know. Oh, you've been sinful, or you didn't listen to Jesus, or you didn't do this, didn't do that, didn't have enough faith, so at death you will go to the eternal flames. Even they have idea of eternal damnation, actually. And even briefly, even in Buddhism, they had idea of ichantika, of someone who never would become enlightened, who would never become free of, which means never become truly happy or free of suffering. Enlightenment means. Don't think enlightenment just means being somehow getting a PhD or graduating from a school. It is like graduating, but the school is the school of reality. And the different kinds of reality. There's the illusory reality that is not really what it seems to be. And then there's the real reality, which luckily we were told by those who claim to have attained it, attained knowledge of it, direct experience of it, is blissful, actually, is happiness. But or freedom from suffering, as they somehow said in those days. But now you have to really emphasize that it's happiness, because the materialist promises you freedom from suffering just by not existing. And so then that's something that has to be scientifically, philosophically, and logically, and commonsensically refuted, that there can be an entry into nothingness by a something, namely a human consciousness. That is just against even common sense, much less reason, philosophy, or science, you know. Can never be part of science, because no one will ever report back in case it did happen. So therefore no one can go ahead and prove it in advance or discover it in advance. It cannot be done, that something can become nothing. And actually it's illogical, because even when they think of it as energy, even your materialist scientists, since they think matter is the only thing that exists, whatever matter is, they have a law that matter can never become nothing. It only changes form. So why is consciousness, the energy, the super subtle energy of consciousness, a different thing? It's the one thing that doesn't exist, that seems to exist but doesn't exist at all. So if something didn't exist at all, it could never seem to exist. Do you realize that? If it existed in a somewhat distorted way, then it could seem to exist in a distorted way and could really exist in another way. But if it was non-existent, absolutely, it could not be there to seem to exist. That's also very logical and commonsensical. So what you are is really important. Then if what you are is just the creation of an omnipotent being who is unchanged and unfazed by whatever happens to you, and in whose presence or whose presence is some sort of an absolute, visualized as an absolute blissfulness, God is supposedly happy, right? Those who believe in a monotheistic creator who is an absolute outside of the world of suffering, then they presumably are imagining also it's outside of suffering and therefore is happy. So if that, so then they say, well, if you, as long as you remain oriented, that one, believe, do what he says, it's usually a he, occasionally in a few parts of the world it's a she. If you do that, then you will be fine at death. So they also give you that promise, and that has at least some sort of attempt at corroboration or proof, in that you have people who have died revealing themselves to mystics or psychics that they're very happy and they're in heaven and God is heaven and everything's fine and you'll be fine and don't be frightened, don't be worried. So at least there's somebody reporting something, although then one has to evaluate that report. You know, like for example, Moses met God, right, or God met Moses on Mount Sinai in the form of a burning bush, and told him to go do this and do that, and Moses was freaked out because it seemed irrational, because that God told him he was omnipotent, he could make anything happen that he wanted, but then he said, Moses, you go ask Pharaoh to let my people go, but then, or actually, I won't help you, in fact, I'll make Moses not agree, but then maybe I'll help you escape. So that seemed sort of irrational to Moses, and he says, well, what is this, and who are you? And then that God told him, well, I am what I am, you know, which wasn't actually a proof. But Moses, you know, was powerful enough, the whole thing, that Moses, that made Moses think he better do what the entity told him to do. So, but that wouldn't convince a scientist. If you say, well, nirvana is what it is, so what? So therefore, Buddha didn't try to say that. Buddha said, I attain nirvana, yes, and I'm really happy, and it is happiness, and it is freedom from suffering, and you can attain it. But you know what? You can't attain it just by believing what I just said, because it's in a way it's indescribable. It's beyond description, A. And B, just believing in it doesn't attain it for you. And it isn't going to reach out from itself and help you attain it, because it's not a person, you know. It's your true state. You know, it's you, if you understood yourself. That's what nirvana is. So therefore, it has already reached out in a way, or let's say it's already reached out. It's up for you to try to peel away your misunderstanding. Your problem is you don't understand it. So therefore, in a way, of course, to really know what you are means you have investigated yourself, and you have examined and explored, and you've looked from every angle, and you've experienced every aspect. And for example, you're made of atoms, supposedly, and your neurons are made of atoms, and then atoms are a very different thing than a seeming optic nerve or a little fiber in your brain or whatever you think you are, like this and that kind of a body. And yet you don't experience yourself as atoms. So in a way, you don't experience the reality of that aspect of the reality of yourself. And then there's a higher aspect of the reality of yourself where it's pure energy and it's bliss, actually, according to the non-dualistic bliss, freedom, indivisible, they say, in the esoteric. But he doesn't inflict that or say that to people, even though that doesn't still encapsulate it. It's indescribable, actually. Even a word like bliss is just the opposite of the word stress, of the word pain. Pleasure is the opposite of pain. So these are dualistic, binary, descriptive terms. And whereas this is something beyond any idea of dualistic bliss, it is like total bliss. Supposedly, you know, but even that doesn't help, just to believe that. Maybe it makes you feel a bit better, actually, especially if it counterweights your bad feeling that the world is basically bad. Although materialists don't have that. The materialists have the idea that the world is basically nothing. And it's just that that's so unrealistic that it doesn't help them. You know, but at least it doesn't make them feel it's hell, you know. But on the other hand, it doesn't really cover over the fear that there might be a painful state, which they would fall into uncontrollably through the abyss of dying, you know, through the abyss of losing consciousness. So in fact, a lot of people who are very, very card-carrying materialists, when they reach the deathbed, they call in the rabbi, they call in the priest, they call in their loved ones, they call in those who they want to forgive, or they want to forgive them. And they sort of try to clean things up because they're just not sure that it's really going to be nothing. That's the thing. So anyway, what the Buddhist scientists say is that what you are is a body-mind complex, and that you have reached the human form by your own effort. You have your evolution is an individual affair. It is not just an impersonal affair of a species where the individual has no benefit, but they just carry genes from one location to another, so to speak. It's not that. There's no such selfish gene or unselfish gene. There are genes, of course. There are genes, there are cells, there are molecules, there are atoms, etc. But the reason they are organized into you and you are moving forward is because you think you are something based on your acculturation and your education and your sort of biological equipment and your desire and as a human, in a way, by your ignorance. By your not knowing what you are, therefore you're rushing straight ahead from birth to death, gradually dying every day that you go, and then your advance is just an advance toward the graves. Like when Dalai Lama was here in Woodstock, he was giving a public talk on the common, town common, and there's this town cemetery is next to the common, and he noticed that, and he looked at it before he even started talking. He said, oh, there it is, he said, the final destination. Not that, he meaning, of anybody who thinks they're just a body, that's the final destination. So you're the advance of your daily activity of moving forward. Let's go. You're going and going is actually reaching that cemetery, if that's all you think you are, is the body. And or whatever, the crematorium or whatever it is. So he just said that to shake people up a little bit, you know, in a subliminal way, to be open to thinking about they might be something more valuable, something more precious than a mere body, something that has a longer-term evolutionary impact on themselves and others. And so that, therefore, if you decide that you are an evolutionary being and you have reached this wonderful, intelligent, self-reflective, altruistic, because a mammal, being, you know, who became this being that has language because you didn't immediately eat everybody that you met and they didn't immediately eat you, and you were able to talk with each other and you developed the ability to communicate beyond your body toward those that you care for and love, and even maybe toward those you don't care for and love. But anyway, you developed this amazing human ability to be both a self and selfless. And the ethical, ethical self-restraint of your immediate self-centered grasping, go ahead by consuming others, way in which the lower animals live. And so you're this human, and yet you're more vulnerable than some sort of angelic being where you're just more relaxed and so forth and have a longer life, and you can be afford, therefore, to be more unrealistic, you think, and move ahead into sort of realms of pleasure. You're human sort of in the boundary between the completely helpless and the completely careless. And you're vulnerable, and yet you're really intelligent. You can shape your environment, and you understand the causal processes of different states of being. You're just this amazing person. And you have evolved toward that through laws of evolution, which is called karma, by being generous, by being ethical, meaning other-regarding and sensitive to others, by being patient and not reacting violently to others' violence, and by being creative and energetic and have a lot of effort and strength, and by being concentrated and focused on what is of importance, and then finally, most importantly, by being wise and intelligent and knowing what is going on and discerning what's good from what's bad and what's useful and what's useless and so forth. And so you did this in all kinds of forms where it's very hard to have deeds like that, because you're so hard, you're in such a subsistence situation, and your equipment is so little, your brain is not really that good, and you don't have language, and you're pretty much stuck in a particular environmental niche, and you're adapted only to that niche, and you're driven by your instincts, and you're mostly unconscious. And now you're human, and you can live mostly unconscious, and just diving at what's in front of you, and grabbing at it, and so forth, and just feeding your face, and then the pooping it out and then running along. You can live like that and grabbing more stuff to eat and getting more like this and grabbing more pleasures and having more relationships and getting more status and more fame and more money and more property and more possession, etc., etc., and then dying and then losing all of it. You can do that if you think that's really useful. That's all there is. But if you really understand what you are as a human being, you'll realize, well, what do I have this intelligence for? Well, I have it to attain greater wisdom, to understand my reality more thoroughly, to do what is more appropriate in my reality, to become a greater yet being. And not just in this life, but in many lives to come, because I'm just an evolutionary moment. My whole life from birth to death is but from conception to death, perhaps I should say. My whole life is an evolutionary moment where I have this tremendous opportunity to accelerate that evolution toward a state of real bliss, a state of reliable calm, a state of truly being able to be fully generous, fully ethical, fully tolerant, fully creative, fully concentrated, and fully aware. And then never fear any kind of negative thing for myself, at least, in any future. Never fear that. And also never feared for others and those whom I love, and realizing my interconnectability and connection in history, beginningless, infinite history of interaction, interwovenness with other beings, realizing my complete entanglement with all of these beings, all of whom have been my mother in previous lifetimes in mammal form and in human form. So all these mother living beings, as they say in Tibet, all the mother living beings, I have untold capacities of being of benefit in helping them and mothering them actually into freedom, mothering them into their bliss. What a fantastic prospect of your own personal freedom from suffering and bliss and effectiveness and artfulness and capacity, and then helping endless others in the same way. Go in that same direction. What a fantastic prospect that is. So if you decide you might be such a being, then what is the logical, caught endlessly in a network of causation as a relative being, but able to understand fully the total scope of that network of causation and being able to use it to help yourself completely and others, then it becomes logical, if you are such a being, that you use your precious moments, weeks, days, weeks, months, years, decades, lifetimes of being such a being to develop yourself toward that eternal state. You know, not eternal in the sense of out of time totally, but aware of the whole span of time. In that sense, eternal, and therefore aware that you of your presence everywhere and everywhen. There is no word, I realize, that the dictionary in my computer freaks out when I say everywhen. We can say everywhere and print it as a single word, but when we say everywhen, it's like goes thing, tilt, meaning the idea that there's this, you could something could be the case in all time. Is like not intuitive for us. It isn't. Time is invisible to us, you see, the future. It's not like a visible space that, you know, of course we can't see in infinite space, really, unless we become infinite. But we'd have to be it, even. And if we became infinite, we couldn't see it, we'd just have to be it. But we can see sort of larger spaces than us in our environment, and then imagine there's endlessly larger spaces. Actually, it's a little, people tend to be frightened thinking they're endlessly larger spaces, and therefore people tend to be afraid of infinity, and they shouldn't be, because they already are in their infinity. You know, infinity cannot be excluded by the perimeter of their skin, or it wouldn't be infinity, right? So it's nothing to fear. You're already in infinity. You already are infinity in that sense. Anyway, never mind. So you decide what you are. And then if you decide you are an evolutionary, then as an evolutionary, you want to be skillful in your evolution. You want to contribute and reinforce and strengthen and create the causes that will cause your evolution to go more positive. And you want to diminish and negate and reject and dissociate yourself from the causes that will make things go more negative and lead to pain and to suffering. And then basically initially for yourself, but also for others. Since you, as you become expand as a being, you become more and more able to identify with others, and their suffering becomes like your suffering. You're not just narrowly restricting suffering to what you do. So then it becomes logical. And so then when you go on a retreat from your normal daily life, where you're just rushing ahead toward these goals that are not ultimately going to be satisfying, they're going to be crushed by death and old age and sickness and misfortune and attacks by others and failure of support by others. All of these things are going to befall you, and yet that's all you're charging forward toward goals that will not turn out to be satisfying. And if you, now that you have opened your mind to the possibility that there might be more satisfying goals, of course you will turn your mind toward those. And doing retreats of proper healthily material but also spiritual kind, like we have at Menla Mountain Retreat here, or like they have many retreat places around from all different spiritual traditions, and even secular humanist retreats. And you go to really think about the meaning of things, to think about the purpose of your life. And then different ones will say, well, the purpose is to love Jesus, or the purpose is to be a good biologist, or to invent a wonderful medicine that will cure cancer, or the purpose is whatever it may be. It's fine. They're all good if they're all higher purposes. There isn't one that's better than another. And you can't say that, well, being a Buddha is the best. Although actually, in a way, you could say that the concept of Buddha in cultures that have a concept for that is by definition the best. In other words, or even the idea that there is a best is particular, perhaps, to that, and then they just define that as a Buddha. So if you think to become one with God is the best, because God is defined as happiness, calm, peacefulness, power not to be disturbed or troubled by anybody, then in a way you have defined God the way that Buddhists define Buddha, and also able to enfold others in their compassion to a total degree, amount, total degree, to help them completely become free of suffering also, then that God has been defined just like a Buddha, so it's just as good. It doesn't matter the word Buddha or God. And there are a few people who do define their God like that. And maybe there are people who, but the, you know, I think they kind of given up. The people who define their goal as nothing, which means logically you're already nothing, the real essential you, and you're, this body just running along. Those are really unfortunate, because their idea of the best is nothing. And that's not really fun, you know. Being nothing is no fun. Of course, it's no pain, so it's midway between the most horrible, eternal suffering, eternal damnation in hellfire. So it's the worst thing that can be imagined, which is completely stupid and impossible. There's no eternal. But unfortunately, there might be temporary, serious, long-term suffering, but nothing eternal. In a world of causality and change, once there's a best, there could be a worst. But in a way, a best is such that the best is where there is no worst, I guess. That's even better. Yeah, let's say that. So a Buddha, for a Buddha, there are no hells. You know? Doesn't mean people can't make temporary hells out of their time by behaving so badly and by being so unskillful in their evolutionary acts that they can de-evolutionize themselves towards states of very strong suffering. As far as they're concerned, but for a Buddha, those states are less real than the real condition of those beings, which is still inner bliss, even in the midst of what they've twisted around themselves, tangled themselves up in the barbed wire life they've put themselves into, where it's like hell for them. But they call it hell. So really there's no real hell in that sense. Like there's no real heaven, like there's no real between hell and heaven. But there is an unreal one, let's say. So anyway, so that's why I call a retreat an advance. Because then you're advancing on what you're really here for. And not that someone has put you here for that. Because no one is really in full control of you. But you are here because you have evolved in this way toward this situation. And actually, because the best, the Buddhas, the Buddha gods, the gods of gods, you know, the great gods who are Buddha gods, not creator gods, but Buddha gods. They have been helping you all along, actually. When you think you decided to be nice instead of destroying something or someone in front of you, and you think that's your choice, that's fine, and it's good that you take responsibility. But actually there's like a a billion, million best beings, good beings, who are trying every way possible to nudge you in the direction of that choice, put it that way. So you've had help. You've had help. And when people begin to realize that in the literature, you know, and they get all devoted, they'll say, well, every good thing that anything happens to anybody in the universe is you're doing, O Buddha. Just like people say that about God or Jesus or Muhammad or whoever it might be, you know. They will say that. And that's great because that they're seeing the Buddha in those beings. The completely compassionate, completely aware and awake being in those beings. So do this, now that you're in summer, take some advances. Have some advances. Go to your neighborhood church or mosque or Dharma center or retreat center or secular humanist resort. And then don't just do it for just pure lollygagging and get all energetically rushing around in all the games and the rides and the whatever it is and wear yourself out going after more pleasure. But rather, of course they should be pleasant, but go after more health, go after more insight, go after more understanding. Be more critical about what you think you're doing. Even if you're sure it's the best, cross-check, double-check. Double-check that what you're doing is really the best way to be doing. For yourself and others. For your happiness and theirs. For avoiding misery and suffering of yours and avoiding their misery and suffering. Make sure that's the case. And that's what the true retreat slash advance, the true advancing, evolutionarily advancing retreat. And ideally, you'll become an evolutionary. You will be an evolutionary, not a revolutionary. It might be sometimes it's revolutionary to be an evolutionary if there's a worldview that you're trapped within where you think there is no place to evolve to because it's all nothing. If you're trapped in that deadly worldview, that imprisoning, depressing, that's the worldview that creates the national and international epidemic of depression because it's all useless. It's stressful, but nevertheless ultimately useless. And this sort of relative use within it just being nothing is just delusion. You know as you do it, so you don't really, it's all half-hearted. So please try to, you know, escape from that one by thinking critically about it, not just because I said so. And thinking, who has evidence that nothing is something? Why do people say that? They think nothing is a place you can go. Nothing is a condition of your consciousness. Nothing is an essential being of yourself, even. Who says that? And based on what evidence? Did someone see the nothing? Then it is a nothing. It's a visual object. Did they find it? Then it's not a nothing. It's a findable object. Did they hear it? Did they imagine it? What they imagine is some notion they have of nothing. It's not nothing. Nothing is the word for what is unimaginable, unfindable, doesn't exist, is not there or here or when or then or whatever. Nothing is not. That's the key point of nothing. Everything, therefore, is something. You are, your consciousness is, your pleasure, your pain, it's something. It may not be the thing you think it is, but it's something. That's the logical thing. So have an advance and go toward better somethings and improve all the somethings around you in the world. And that will be truly great. Meanwhile, we're here in the U.S. of A. And U.S. of A. at least has the idea of freedom, which is the ultimate reality, really. It has that in its constitution. It also has happiness, of course, only to be pursued, not necessarily to be guaranteed, but to be pursued at least. So that's at least an acknowledgement there is such a thing, and it might be a purpose of living. So those are two great steps, actually, because probably the founders of this country, you know, of this country, as imperfect as they were, as racist as they were, as sexist as they were, as, you know, Eurocentric as they were, as the Eurocentric ones were, they at least conceived of these ideas. I think they were the reincarnations of bodhisattvas. And in a way, let's say the native people who welcomed them initially to the planet, to the continent, most of them, and who tried again and again to get along with them and who accepted their treaties and their promises and things, and who still find them broken, but they're still there. And the great ones among them don't hate the people, even the ones who violated them. They realize they're just misled. They're just crazed. They think they're advancing toward the West Coast. They're advancing toward greater this and that, advancing toward more and more money. You read the great book, Lame Deer Speaks, and you realize that they also are founders of our country. They also love its earth and its water and its air and its temperature. And they love the creatures on it, including the weird, you know, whatever, white ghosts or whatever they think of us, they called us in the old days, who were so destructive and violent to them. And they have loved us over the years and centuries. They've intermarried with our people. They're mixed in with us. There's just no doubt, no way around it. So. Then the black people, they have given so much to this country. They founded so much. They built all the capital buildings. They were, of course, not willingly, they were brought, but then they are such wonderful people. They got into the work, you know, they loved seeing it done thing, even though they weren't getting proper benefit of it, and they were being abused, and their loved ones were taken from them and resold and whatever, and they're whipped and beaten the worst way. And then since they were emancipated, they've been not emancipated, and now they're under mass incarceration, etc. And yet they sing. In the paper the other day was a guy who playing the saxophone around in different bars and in different centers at 102. It's incredible. Happily playing there. Because, you know, life is beautiful if you are loving, if you're a loving person. And even slaves have a minute to be loving. It's why it's so painful and wrong to be slaves. And there's still slavery in the planet, actually, by people. It's terrible. But anyway, the idea that there is such a thing as freedom, that ultimately everyone should have it, that women even eventually should have it, that's sort of planted there, even though they didn't have it when they had the idea, is a good thing. And America, in spite of its bad leadership and terrible worship of money nowadays, it has gotten this worst kind of leadership and lack of bodhisattva leadership. America is beloved around the world by people who don't have any freedom and who are not allowed to be happy. And they think that we are, you know, because it's our idea. But they don't know how few really are, and how some who get power and wealth and so forth don't think others should have any, you know, even in our own country, and are sort of oppressive and horrible to them. And we've come into this time of terrible inequality. But nevertheless, and we've never lived our ideals, you know, since the Declaration of Independence. In a way, independence is, there is no real independence. except freedom from suffering. But yet, there's relative independence. There's political independence. There's psychological independence. And one aspect of it is good. You are independent and free to go on an advance, on a retreat / advance, and find out the purpose of your life somewhere, somehow, you know. And that you're not allowed to do in many places, in many countries, still on this human planet. And if you read Thomas Jefferson's second inaugural, Thomas Jefferson for all his faults, he talks about how our real great gift to the world is to lead a better life, to show there's a better way of being, more loving, more helpful to others, more compassionate, more enlightened, more educated, more democratic, more finding the talent at every level of society, less class system, less caste system, less wealth oligarchy, less male dominance, if that ultimately all unpacks out into. And that's what we do best, and we shouldn't get involved in entanglements and conflicts that are old. We should rise above them here. And of course, he's saying that still standing on the land of Indians, and with slaves in his possession. So you can just debunk it all and say it's all crap and it's all nonsense and we're no good. But that would be missing a certain point that we should remember on this July 4th. It can be used as a day, it can be a day of advance. It can be used as a day of advance. And we can realize that our freedom is what we, not what we're keeping away from other people and kicking them out, but it's what we offer to other people, what we try to offer for them. And maybe since the World War, we've become this world's policeman. It's not really true, the violence of our art. You can't offer that by violence. You ultimately offer it by example. And you can't really have a free internally society that's free internally when you are imposing military dominance on others. That military dominance on others will go along with a police state on yourselves, because you're violating your own people by sending them out to be violent on other people and training them to be violent. So ultimately, now, of course, in a world where there are people who are bent on conquests and things, you should have to, you could be allowed to defend an area where you're having your people seek freedom. Tibet was a country like that, where they sought freedom, where they, but, and they completely replaced the monastery, I mean the military, by the monastery. And the monastery wasn't just a place where people went and beat their breasts and said, I'm a sinner and it's awful and it's horrible and I'm going to deprive myself, which is what Protestants think of monastics. That's not what those Tibetan centers were. They were universities. They were, the people had that lifestyle to avoid family, to avoid the distraction of sort of having to provide mundane things. They had enough wealth to do that with their limited population. And they had the isolation from others by their altitude and by their geology that enabled them to do that for a long time. But ultimately, they got conquered by the Industrial Revolution, funneled through the ideology of Chinese communism and through the ideology of the Chinese people driven to distraction by a materialist ideology, away from their old ancient balance in their own version of the Buddha Dharma, the seeking of the best type of system, as imperfect as they understood it, too. So Tibet was like that, and Tibet should be restored back to be like that. Of course, with the better infrastructure and more better communication with the world. So Tibet and America have this meeting point there, that freedom is in their basic constitution, let's say. And it was in the past, actually, even without the documents of democracy, and now it has the documents of democracy that His Holiness the Dalai Lama so wonderfully gave to it. And His Holiness, therefore, loves America. And he's loved all of our presidents, even the crazy ones. And although now his compassion is going being put to a really great test with our personal the poor man who is like suffering in that White House today. Really, it's not his favorite place at all. Didn't really realize what it would mean to try to meld business attitude and empire with the empire of freedom of our democratic temporary leadership. So happy 4th of July. When the rocket's red glare goes off, you think about how this represents opening your chakras in your inner heart, feeling well-being within your, all over yourself, all over your body. Giving yourself a break, giving yourself freedom on a holiday and enjoying quality time with those that you love. Or, and if you don't love yourself enough to give yourself an advance or a retreat, taking a retreat. And I wish you all the best. Om Tari Tu Tari Turi Swaha. May the Mother Tara look over your holiday and your happiness today, of all days, in this country, and try to remember what it's about. And don't let it be hijacked by people who try to pretend it's about some sort of dominance thing, some sort of closure, when it's actually about opening. Okay? All the best.
This podcast was made possible through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership and listeners like you. If you're inspired by what you hear in these weekly podcasts, be sure to like and share on your favorite social media platform. And when in New York City, be sure to visit Tibet House US. And when in upstate New York, visit its retreat center, Menla Mountain, located in Phoenicia, New York. Podcast music provided weekly by Tenzin Chogyal. All rights reserved.